Welcome. In this episode, we're honored to welcome Dr. Barry Goff, one of Canada's foremost naval and imperial historians, whose deep research into British Columbia's colonial past brings clarity to the contested stories of land, law, and Indigenous development. In this episode of The Cauldron, we'll examine First Nations treaties. Together, we'll explore the early and often uneasy relations between British Columbian authorities and First Nations, why treaties were signed in some regions and not in others, the meaning of Crown title in the Indigenous eyes, and how negotiations, or the lack of them, continue to echo through modern legal battles over lands and rights. Dr. Goff will guide us through these pivotal moments. This is not just history. It's the backstory to today's court cases, pipeline disputes, and the very definition of reconciliation. Stay with us as we dive deep into the cauldron of early British Columbia, where land was claimed, voices were raised, and the future of a nation took root in fragile understandings.
Among the most dramatic and unsettling periods of British Columbia's history were the years 1871 to 1914. That is, from British Columbia's entry into Canadian Confederation to the opening of the Great War. It was a time of turmoil, of unions, problems, and opportunities, of workers' agitation, of Indigenous change, loss of lands, the coming of religions, changes by missions, and of course the great technological changes of steam power and navigation, the opening up of roads to the interior, and the coming of the telegraph and later the wireless, and of course steam navigation and railways. So that's why I call this period the cauldron. It's the boiling time, the huge energizing of all these new factors that are changing an old Hudson Bay Company dominated territory with prominent Indigenous persons throughout the coast in the majority in numbers, to the period of the decline of Indigenous numbers and the coming of another revolution, which I'm going to talk about today, which I'm sure many are familiar with in the generality, but I want to get to the specifics of it today. And that is what we call generally and generically Indian administration. The term is still in use under the general heading of Indian affairs. Now, by this, we do not mean Indigenous management of these things, though there was always a desire to have that. As of our current times, and I'm speaking in the year 2025, the official terms are Indigenous Services Canada, which has a mandate that focuses on improving access to high-quality services for First Nations, Inuit, and Métis. This includes healthcare, education, infrastructure, child and family services. Its goal is to support Indigenous peoples in closing socioeconomic gaps and advancing self-determination. Equally important, and I'm running on parallel with this, is Crown Indigenous Relations and Northern Affairs Canada, CERNAC. Its mandate, it handles nation-to-nation relationships, self-government agreements, land claims, reconciliation, and treaty rights. And its goal is to renew the relationship between the Crown and Indigenous peoples based on recognition of rights, respect, cooperation, and partnership. Now, mention here of the Crown needs under scoring in our discussion, because in the big treaties that were established in Treaty 8, which is in the northeastern corner of British Columbia, the Crown and the rights of Canada was engaging in relationships with the Indigenous peoples of those areas under Treaty 8, number 8. And to this day, various tribes and bands and nations of Indigenous persons in Canada cleave to the argument that they are sovereign nations and they're recognized by the Crown. So when we talk about crown-to-crown relationships, this is absolutely part of the whole scenario. In 2025, as going back to 1855 in the province of Ontario, the Indian Act established a relationship between the Crown in the right of those governments, in that case the Ontario government, later the Canada government after 1867, with the various tribes and peoples who were recognized and given crown rights. This is an extremely important point to understand because the Crown is the guardian and protector of Indian and Indigenous persons in Canada. And in some of the treaties, this is distinctly recognized. It was less well known and recognized in the province of British Columbia. And herein lies a major problem that has continued to this day without full resolution, though the signs are very strong that this process is working on a daily basis and is on a regular basis. New treaties are being signed to close the gap, as was said before. Now, in this regard, it's important to note it's important not to confuse Indian title with the absolute or underlying title to the land. Absolute title, which is a European concept, has been vested in the Crown ever since Britain, Spain, Russia, and the United States, without consulting any Indians, settled the questions of sovereignty over this continent. The Indians of Canada, whether by choice or not, and whether they have treaties or not, are subjects of the Crown, and the Crown owns the land. Of course, the Indians did own the land previously under clearly defined concepts of ownership. This Indian title, quote unquote, has been recognized by the Crown as a burden on its sovereignty. And steps have been taken to extinguish the native rights by treaty. In fact, it could be said that by the Royal Proclamation, 1763, and subsequent precedents, the Crown has legally obligated itself to recognize and extinguish Indian title. I'm quoting from the famous work by Wilson Duff, The Indian History of British Columbia. To this day, this right of recognition, this necessity, and this obligation of recognition of Indian title has been the position taken by, in the days that we're talking about here now, in the 1870 to 1914, by the Dominion of Canada, now the Government of Canada. The fiduciary obligation means that the Crown looks after and is responsible. This has been demonstrated and underlined by legal obligations at court that the Crown has the obligation to look after Indigenous affairs. It cannot rest. It's an ongoing obligation. It can't be set aside. It can never lapse. And hence the relationship that exists between bands and tribes in their continual demands upon the Government of Canada for proper housing, for clean water, for access to resources, et cetera, because it's understood implicitly that the Crown and the right of Canada has this duty. And this is also set forth not only in the BNA Act or the Canada Act, as it's now called, but it's set forth in the Indian Act, which is a federal statute which defines Indian status and who is Indian and who is not. Now, in 1871, which is our start point for this discussion, when Canada became a province of Canada, the administration of Indian affairs began to undergo profound changes because the jurisdiction had passed from Victoria to Ottawa and to the distant Secretary of State, who was part of the government in Ottawa. The knowledge of West Coast Indians and their special problems was, to say the least, somewhat limited. Recall that there was no direct communication in 1871 between Ottawa and Victoria. The route by a train would lead through the United States or around Cape Horn, even. The concepts of building a transcontinental railway and having the steel of empire, as one author once called it, was only yet a dream. And British Columbia had various demands for what was going to be required when it joined the Federation. But the control of Indian affairs was not one of them. And neither were any conditions put on the size of Indian reserves. All of that passed to Ottawa and to the Department of Indian Affairs, which developed in consequence of that. So, in other words, the province had little power in controlling Indian affairs about recognition of Indian title. In fact, the province of British Columbia, and this goes back to 1863 when they ran out of money to purchase Aboriginal title in the colony of British Columbia. As of 1871, the only thing that the province had an interest in was the conveyance of tracts of land to the Dominion in trust for the Indians. Now, Indian reserves are crown land in the right of Canada. That means that the indigenous peoples whose reserves these are do not own those lands, but it is their home, their native area, and they pride themselves on that. Even if they don't have title to the land where their houses are. It may seem rather confusing from our perspective to think that this arrangement is the way it is, but that is in fact the case. Now, the transition from provincial jurisdiction to federal jurisdiction was proved less than smooth. With the governments disagreeing on the interpretation of these terms, and the Indians finding more and more effective ways of presenting their demands themselves. And it's this latter point about Indian effectiveness in presenting demands, which is really a subcurrent which rises itself. And I'll speak about that towards the end of my remarks here in this podcast. It took several years to create an administrative structure to handle Indian matters in British Columbia and several decades to settle the complicated and troublesome problem of Indian reserves. The question of Indian title, the land question, was in issue the entire time and is perhaps still not finally settled, even though we've had cases like the Chilcotin case, the Nisga'a case, the Mears Island case, the Musqueam case, and others. But it's still a matter that continues to be worked on by Indian treaty commissioners by the province in relationship to the bans. Most of these cases are settled at court. Some do not go happily for Indigenous peoples, as it was in the case of the Nootka Island case recently. But we go over that from now. The policy of the Indian Affairs branch was to work itself out of a job by finding ways to integrate the Indians as full citizens of their provincial and local communities. And therein lies another matter, and we're talking specifically of the residential school system, which popped up. These schools popped up on Mears Island, Port Alberni, to give you another example, and at Alert Bay, to give you a third example, and many other cases as well. These were funded and administered by the Dominion of Canada at this time, and they were operated by church groups, Roman Catholics, Presbyterians, Methodists, Anglicans, and others. Now, it so happens that in the period of time that we're talking about, the Indian demands for recognition of Aboriginal title and better Indian administration was weakening on account of the fact that the populations were in decline. They're in decline for a number of reasons. They're in decline because of measles. They were in decline because of smallpox. They were in decline because of diphtheria. And were in decline because of tuberculosis. They were in decline because of syphilis. And Indigenous longevity was being cut short by all these factors. The families were becoming smaller, and so reproduction was not running at a very high rate. Now, John Belshaw has put together a wonderful evaluation of these populations, and in his estimations, which are very fine ones indeed, we can see how there was this great diminution at this period of time. Take, for example, the Haida. In 1836 to 41, they were 6,693 by the census that was done by the Hudson Bay Company's agent there. But their lowest point was in 1915, when they had been reduced to 588. Now, we know that smallpox, 1862, was the biggest cause of this. Now, let's pick out another example at random. Here we are, the New Chalmers. Now, that's the west coast of Vancouver Island. About 13 indigenous tribes or bands. In the year 1835, the Hudson Bay Company census is estimated at 7,500. But by 1924, it was known that there were 1,459 persons. In other words, a very large gap and diminution indeed. In the central area of the Coast Salish peoples, there was an increase from 4,160 in 1835 to 7,000. But that was contrary to the general evolution. So our earlier estimates at the colonial period are between 46,000, 47,000, I should say, to going down to the nadir dates in the early 1900s to about 18,000. So that's a big diminution, isn't it? So we have to keep all of this in mind. Now, in addition to this diminution, there was a squeezing of the Aboriginal lands. Now, Douglas James had thought that the best way of dealing with Indigenous claims to land was to give them what they needed and what they occupied and what they used. So he was generous in this regard. Not as generous as the Canadian terms, which are broad and from as far as the horizon in many cases. But the geography of British Columbia demanded, because of its coastal islands and inlets, and because its mountain trenches required reserves which were smaller, and they were almost quote unquote cheek by jowl with Euro-Canadian villages, transportation hubs, schools, and so forth. So it's difficult indeed to be able to, except for Treaty 8, which is an anomaly in this scenario, as I said, it's very difficult to determine the rightness of the size of this. But when Joseph Trutch became Lieutenant Governor of the province of British Columbia in 1871, his Indigenous policy was that there were many tracts of land which were in Indian reserve capacities in the province of British Columbia, but these were not being used. So he started the process of cutting down the size of some of these reserves, not all of them, but some of these reserves. And from that cutting back on the size of these reserves has come the attack, the scurrilous attack on him as being opposed to Indigenous identity and development. He was one of these fascinating people who was interested in the use of the land being the determinant of ownership. Now, the Canadian government, the Dominion of Canada, had a policy of introducing superintendents of Indian affairs in their various jurisdictions of parts of Canada. And British Columbia became, therefore, a place where it had its first commissioner of Indian affairs. This was a friend of Sir John A. Macdonald's, the prime minister of the day, and his name was Dr. Israel Wood Powell. He was named first commissioner in 1872. Now, his duties were supervisory in the sense that they were for observation purposes only, but he had no budget to assist in social welfare or medical obligations. That's a notable fact. But he was important in making tours of various places, and his inspection of coastal settlements is rather quite famous. It would make a great book for somebody to do someday. In 1873, for instance, in HMS Boxer, and a few years later in the Rocket, and once again in 1881 in the Rocket, he and others were unable to spend much time in the field because of Indian unrest over the land question. And they found themselves that every time they went to these native villages, they got an earful about the problems that existed on reserve. Now, Powell was commissioner until 1890, when he was replaced by a fellow called A. V. Vowell, now Vowell. And he's rather famous because he was the one who began to introduce the anti-potlatch legislation. That's a subject for another podcast, believe me. There were agencies established under the superintendency, Cowichan, the West Coast, Kwakwaka'wakw, Fraser River, Kamloops, and the Okanagan. And then later others were added. And the commissioner sometimes was responsible for the Yukon, as well as all this in British Columbia. Now, each of these agencies had under its control maybe populations of 2 or 3,000 persons, a total of 40,800 as of the year 1963. It persists through that period of time. To conclude this point, the Indian policies of British Columbia differed from all those of the rest of Canada most sharply on matters involving land. First, there was the question of recognizing and extinguishing the Aboriginal possessory rights, or Indian title. In North America, it had been the usual practice, started by Britain and continued by Canada and the United States, to make treaties with the Indian tribes as the country was opened up for settlement. In return for their ownership, the Indians received tracts of land for Indian reservations and compensations in the form of money and gifts, services, and perpetual annual payments. Some people will know about the famous wampum belt, which was a recognition of the crown to crown arrangement. Now, in the Royal Proclamation of October of 1763, it was the representation of the government of the United Kingdom, is issued under the name of King George III. It said that, in effect, the Indians were not to be dispossessed of their lands without their own consent, as well as that of the crown, and that Indian lands were to be ceded only to the crown. No one was to disturb the Indians in their possession of such parts of our dominion and territories as not having been ceded to or purchased by us as reserved to them as their hunting grounds. Now, nothing is more clear in contrast than the arrangements that occur in, say, Treaty Number 7 and Treaty Number 6, dealing with the southern borderland provinces of Saskatchewan and Alberta. There, the federal government enters into relationships with the chiefs. Annuities are established. There may be a medical and an annuity statement. There may be other things, like Crowfoot wanted his own railway station, so he got one. So these were arrangements that were entered into on a broad range. But this never happened in British Columbia, by contrast. And this is the point that I'm trying to make. We had in the Douglas Treaties, which is the subject of another podcast, we had 14 deeds of conveyance dealing with properties such as Sooke, Esquimalt, Victoria, Oak Bay, Saanich, Nanaimo, Kwakwaka'wakw territories at Fort Rupert. And these were distinct treaties, 14 of them all. They were, according to Douglas, deeds of conveyance. They have since been reinterpreted as treaties and upheld in court in consequence of that, in the White and Bob decision in Nanaimo. But all of the rest of the province, other than the Treaty 8 previously referred to, was unextinguished Indian title or Aboriginal title. Now, the province of British Columbia developed a logical position because they had the resources of timber to consider, and they had remnant villages and declining populations to deal with. And the politics of resource extraction were such that the Crown took its own independent position in British Columbia in marketing and exploiting lands to the detriment of the Aboriginal title. The general argument that persisted even as late as the 1960s was that all the lands of British Columbia belonged to all British Columbians. Now, that began to break down with the various decisions that I referred to earlier. These decisions related to fishing rights on the Fraser River. They related to timber rights at Mears Island. They related to the Nisga demands for a separate jurisdiction. The Squamish case, which ended up in municipal government with the Squamish Nation taking control and developing its own municipal arrangement. That's a very important innovation that has worked very, very successfully. And then the Gitskan-Witsuwet'en case and the Chilcotin case, which was the capstone of the recognition of Aboriginal title and rights, although It reserved the question of what the rights were. Those were to have to be demonstrated in court and in judicial affairs. But the point is that the province was at odds with the Dominion, and they fought, as an example, in the Mears Island case, in which I did the background report for the Nishalas Tribal Council. Sitting on the other side were the province of British Columbia and the government of Canada. And they were supporting Fletcher Challenge and the McMillan Bloedel, who'd taken up the case. So you had three parties. You had the indigenous people on the one hand, represented by their lawyers and their chiefs. And on the other side, you had the Crown and the Right of Canada and the Crown and the Right of British Columbia, and the business interests of McMillan Bloedel. Do you see how complicated this can be? In every case, it's been the federal government which has backed the interests of the indigenous claimants, because it's their obligation to do so. Not only is it their obligation to do so under federal law and constitutional rights, but they have a difference of opinion about the size of reserves that British Columbia, in its position, which was an open question about Aboriginal rights. And so the government of Canada had history on its side east of the Rocky Mountains, and British Columbia had the rights of history on its side west of the Continental Divide. So this ends up in the quagmire of the cauldron in terms of rights. Who owns what? And as of the year 1914, which is the end of the cauldron period, there were many cases that had yet to be resolved. Just one indication of the support of the federal government for the indigenous peoples of British Columbia. I quote from a letter from David Mills, who was the Secretary of State looking after the case, to Dr. Powell in the year 1877. Indian rights to soil in British Columbia have never been extinguished. Should any difficulty occur, steps will be taken to maintain the Indian claims to all the country where rights have not been extinguished by treaty. Don't desire to raise the question at present, but local government must instruct commissioners to make reserves so large as to completely satisfy Indians. Thus, as we have that very, very good example. Now, jumping forward in time, closer to the end of the cauldron period, in 1906, we have a delegation of the Squamish Nation and other southern coastal tribes going to London. They're receiving a hearing, but no real satisfaction. There was an instance when the Crown in the United Kingdom said, well, this is all very well. We understand that you're subjects of the Crown, and we're happy to hear the case, but there's nothing we can do about this. This is a Canadian matter, and indeed it was a Canadian matter. And looking at it from the imperial point of view, they also had Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and many another part of the world to deal with it in regards to this. The Nass Indians, or the Nishka, formed a land committee to raise funds and obtain professional legal advice. And in the year 1913, they adopted and sent to Ottawa the Nishka petition, stating their land claim and asking that it be tested before the highest court, the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council in London. But that body can hear only cases appealing from lower courts, and the Indians refused to have their case tried first in a lower Canadian court, maintaining truthfully that they had been promised a direct hearing before the Privy Council. The Nishka delegations traveled to Ottawa in 1915 and 16 in unsuccessful attempts to win this concession. So the Nishka expanded their zone of interest and activity, and they formed the Allied Tribes of British Columbia, which becomes a very powerful inter-tribal organization. And it was led by two outstanding leaders of their generation, Peter Kelly and Andrew Paul, P-A-U-L-L. Peter Kelly and Andrew Paul, these people are famous in British Columbia Indigenous rights leadership. And they held meetings, they talked it up, they sent petitions to Ottawa. Their reports were often rejected or delayed by governments until about the year 1924, when they started to demand other things, including having acreages of 160 acres per person. They demanded certain numbers of dollars in recompense, $2.5 million and so forth. And the reserve commissioners were unable to satisfy these claims from the Allied Tribes of British Columbia. But note that the Nisga'a, who are the leaders in this, are among the first. Indeed, I think they are the first, apart from the Squamish, that did theirs under this municipal arrangement, as I previously mentioned. The Nisga'a brought their case forward and won successfully and established their great homeland arrangements, which they did in the 1980s and 1990s. There had been in 1912 a special commission established. I will close with this now. And this special commission was a two-person commission. The Dominion commissioner was McKenna, J.A.J. McKenna, and Sir Richard McBride was the premier of the province of British Columbia, and he was the person who represented as the head of government and the head of lands control as well. The interests of the province of British Columbia. The result was the McKenna-McBride Agreement, and a five-man royal commission was appointed to make the final and complete allotment of Indian lands in the province. Now that sounds very final, doesn't it? Upon settlement of the number and the size of reserves, title was to be conveyed to the Dominion free of any reversionary interest, except in the case of lands belonging to bands which might become extinct. This Royal Commission on Indian Affairs, now usually referred to as the Reserve Commission, was named in the year 1913 and labored for three busy years, traveling to all parts of the province and interviewing virtually all bands. Some of the northern coastal peoples refused to discuss their reserve requirements until the question of Indian title had been settled, and their needs had to be judged from information given by the Indian agents. In most cases, the commission confirmed the existing reserves, but it also added about 87,000 acres of new reserve land and cut off some 47 acres of the old land. Its report, and it's very, very big in four volumes, published in 1916, was ratified by both governments in the year 1924, and the reserve lands were formally conveyed by the Dominion by order and council in 1938, and with some minor adjustments. And then, since then, this was the final settlement of the Indian land questions between the two governments. And in 1963, 189 bands owned a total of 1,620 reserves, with a total area of 843,478 acres. So the Indian title question continues. It's the baseline for the discussion between the lawyers representing the province and being acted by the treaty commissioners as assigned for individual cases. And on the other side are the various in councils the indigenous tribes and bands that are represented. The arrangements are tortuous. They're always wide-ranging. The question of documentation or claims or the nature of the documentation are often at odds. And from time to time, these well-meaning commissions with these two different parties having such widely different points of view have often come crashing to an end by one party, invariably the indigenous party, walking out because they believe that their interests are not properly being recognized. And there were cases too, like in the Delgamuukw decision, where there were questions on the authenticity of the oral technique and oral evidence being used and accepted in government. Now it remains for us to look at the potlatch, which we will do in a subsequent number of this cauldron series. So thank you for your attention to this important subject. It's not over. It's an organic subject. It continues to be a burning issue. I'm Barry Goff, the creator of the Cauldron series. I thank you for your attention to this dramatic, earth-shaking period, and I hope you will join me again. So again, I'm Barry Goff, signing off. Thank you.